Is that too dark? Okay. Slide 4 shows you a cartoon of an atom, and I'll tell you in a minute why this is actually a lie, but atoms are building blocks of matter. All material objects in the universe are made out of atoms. Despite being building blocks of everything that's material, atoms themselves are actually built out of even smaller things called subatomic particles. And if you get deeply enough into the science, which we're not going to in this biology course, you'll see that these primary subatomic particles are even made out of things. But we are only going to study the three primary subatomic particles, because those are the ones that matter to biology. And those subatomic particles are protons, neutrons, and electrons. Subatomic simply means below the level of the atom, smaller than the atom, like an organelle is a subcellular structure, smaller than a cell. And any given atom is really defined by its nucleus. I mean, the reason it exists is because there's an atomic nucleus there. Without a nucleus, you don't really have an atom. And just be careful with the term nucleus, which in general means the center or the core of something. But so far, I've been using the word nucleus to refer to a cell nucleus, as in eukaryotic cells. So that's it. That's a much huger structure than an atomic nucleus. Even though one cell is invisibly small, we can't see it with the naked eye, a cell has many millions of atoms in that single cell. So atoms are truly, truly tiny things from our perspective. And the atomic nucleus is even smaller, but the atomic nucleus is a space where you find up to two of these three subatomic particles. What really defines the nucleus is that's where all of the protons that atom contains are found. So any atomic nucleus contains at least one proton. That's the bare minimum to be an atomic nucleus. But however many protons an atom has, all of those protons will be found in the nucleus, never outside of the nucleus. Some atoms, in addition to having protons in the nucleus, have neutrons. And if there are neutrons in the atom, which depends on the atom, all of them will be also found in the nucleus. Okay, so a nucleus contains one or more protons and all of the protons, plus zero or more neutrons and all of the neutrons of the atom. That leaves the electrons, the third category of subatomic particles, which are never found in the nucleus. They are found somewhere outside of the nucleus, in the space outside of the nucleus. Okay, that's some of the differences between these. Now, neutrons get their name because they are neutral with respect to electrical charge. They don't have an electrical charge. Protons and electrons, on the other hand, are charged subatomic particles. So that's another difference. One thing that this cartoon gets pretty right is that the size, the mass of neutrons is almost identical to the mass of protons. Not quite, but very, very close to being the same mass. Remember, the mass is how much stuff is in something. So the brown neutrons here are depicted as being the same size as the magenta protons. The big difference, therefore, between protons and neutrons is the fact that neutrons don't have a charge, protons do. And protons are not only charged, they are specifically positively charged, which is why each magenta proton here has a plus sign on it. Electrons are negatively charged, but they are much, much smaller than protons. And that's one of the things that this cartoon is lying to you about. It shows the electrons being smaller than protons, but the size difference is actually much, much more drastic than that. You wouldn't really be able to see the electrons if they showed it their size comparison correctly. So that's just a cartoon. So a huge disparity of mass between tiny electrons and much bigger protons. But electrons are negatively charged. And despite this huge disparity in the size between electrons and protons, the magnitude of the charges are the same. What I mean by the magnitude is the size of the charge. What I mean by that is that the positive charge that a single proton carries is no bigger, despite the huge size compared to the electron, than the size of the negative charge that an electron carries. And so one tiny electron's negative charge completely counteracts, in terms of adding up positives and negatives, the plus one positive charge of a much bigger proton. Another thing I should say is that all electrons are the same as each other. All protons are the same as each other. All neutrons are the same as each other throughout the universe. So there aren't different kinds of these subatomic particles. And therefore, when we talk about different kinds of atoms, which is what elements, what determines elements, they're made of different kinds of atoms, it's not really different kinds of subatomic particles. It's just different numbers of those subatomic particles that all materials share. All right? Since the charge of electrons is just as big as the charge of a proton, if you have the same number of protons as you have electrons in an atom, then that number of positives plus that same number of negatives adds up to zero. And the overall atom, therefore, is electrically neutral. And that's really the proper way of using the word atom. When we say atom, we are implying that that atom, that structure, is electrically neutral and therefore has the same number of electrons as protons. Now that doesn't have to be the case, but we stop calling it an atom if it's not the case, and we use the other word ion that we'll talk about in a little bit instead of atom. So atom really assumes that it's neutral. Okay, so the other even bigger lie that you're given here in this figure is that electrons, even though they are somewhere outside of the nucleus, do not circle the nucleus in a circular orbit like is implied here. That is a lie. We actually don't know, it's impossible mathematically to determine at any given moment the exact location of an electron. All we can do is predict it with probability. We know where it's more likely to be in a region compared to another region, but we don't know specifically where it is. And so there's an improvement on the lies in slide 5. B is the same thing I just showed you, but A is a little bit closer to the truth because it doesn't show individual electrons and being in a specific place. Instead, it depicts the electrons as this yellow cloud, an electron cloud, which mathematically really is what's called a probability space. What's represented here is that the more yellow that is, the deeper yellow, the greater the likelihood that an electron could be there at any given moment. And notice that it fades off as you get farther from the nucleus. And of course, it's also a lie because protons are not really magenta with plus marks on them. Okay, let's go to 6. And start talking about some spaces. And this can be confusing, so don't hesitate to stop me, as always, if it's not making sense. Spaces, though, are not materials. The particles themselves that we just talked about, electrons, protons, and neutrons, so those are materials. Spaces, though, are just places where things can be, right? And the spaces I'm going to talk about are outside of the nucleus, around the nucleus. So they are places where electrons might be found or can exist. But we're going to talk about three levels of spaces. And so think about this kind of like mathematical sets. You can have a big set of something, and if you take out just certain members, that's a subset, right, of that bigger set. And the subset itself could have subsets in it. Similarly with spaces. These are not materials, but we're going to have a nested arrangement of spaces. And the biggest spaces, the biggest level of spaces, are depicted here in slide 6. These are called, well, they go by interchangeable names. They can be called energy levels, or they can be called electron shells, or just shells sometimes. And one major point that's being depicted by these figures is that any given electron belongs to one shell or another, and it has to be in that shell or it has to be in another shell. It can't be halfway between shells or energy levels. That's what the ball on the stairs is all about. If you actually go through with the experiment of dropping a ball, bouncing a ball downstairs, you can do it as many times as you like, and it's never going to be the case that a ball stops at step 2.5, right, and just hangs there. It might land on any of the steps. It might go all the way down and land on the floor, but it's never partially between levels. And similarly with electrons. Each electron is in one level or shell or another. Now, an electron can go up or down in levels. And the reason these things are called energy levels is because the shell or level closest to the nucleus is at the lowest energy level. And that's where electrons would like to be if they're allowed in. Electrons are negatively charged. The nucleus contains positively charged protons, so electrons are attracted to the nucleus. But any given level can hold a maximum number of electrons. And that's what I meant by if they are allowed in. So if there are more than a shell can handle, additional electrons will have to be at a higher level. But since these are energy levels, if energy is supplied, and I'll talk more about this when we get to photosynthesis, if an atom is excited, meaning its energy is delivered to it, that might force electrons up in energy levels. But they will want to come back down, and usually will, and when that happens, then the atom will release energy, because energy is going down as electrons descend to the lower levels. Okay, so that's the broadest of the spaces, the energy levels. And those are simply numbered, 1, 2, 3, and so on, with 1 being the one closest to the atomic nucleus. Now, any given atom we refer to as having energy levels, since they're just spaces, you know, you can go as high as you want. But we only really consider energy levels if they have at least one electron in them. All right? But the periodic table is, of course, a table, and so has rows and columns, but we don't call them rows and columns, right? What are the rows of the periodic table? What are they called instead of rows? Does anyone know?
Periods?
They are periods, yes. And what about the columns?
Groups.
Well, each period or row in the periodic table represents an energy level. And that's why on the left-hand side here you have 1, 2, 3. Those are the periods. Well, those are the numbers of the energy levels. Okay? And if a hydrogen atom, for instance, the simplest atom, simplest element, has only one electron, and therefore it exists at the lowest energy level, and we don't really say that hydrogen has level 2. Yes, it's there as a space, but if it's totally empty, we don't talk about it. I should say, by the way, before we go on, that what defines an element, I can't remember whether I've already told you this, and you might already know, is exactly one thing. Now, all elements are made out of these subatomic particles we've been talking about. But what defines any given atom as an atom of that particular element is only the number of protons that are in the nucleus. That alone defines the atom as being helium or lithium or whatever. All right? And that's the ordering of the periodic table. Each atom in the periodic table, each element, has a symbol, of course, which tells you what it is. But in this version, in blue integers to the upper right of the symbol, is a number that's called the atomic number, which tells you the number of protons that that type of atom has. And that is the only thing that makes each of those atoms that kind of atom. So hydrogen is hydrogen only if and only because there's exactly one proton in its nucleus. If it has two protons, it's no longer hydrogen, it's helium, number two, and so on. But, as I was saying before, if we're talking about an atom, and therefore a neutral atom of hydrogen, along with that one proton that makes it hydrogen to begin with, it also has to have one electron to counteract the positive charge of that proton. And that one electron is in one of these energy levels, the first energy level. Okay, so that's one space. Now, if we go on to slide 7, we can talk about two more levels of space. You got to be careful saying the word level because it's already defined as one of these spaces. But each level, energy level, or shell, electron shell, is made up of subspaces, some number of subspaces, one or more. And those subspaces are called subshells, right below the level of the shell itself, or the level. Those subspaces then, however many there are in turn subdivided into subspaces themselves. And that third level, or that third subdivision of spaces, is called orbitals. Okay, so a shell is made up of some number of subshells, and each of those subshells, however many there are, is made up of some number of orbitals. And these are all spaces. They're not materials. So this is a hierarchical arrangement, right? Like kingdom, phylum, class is getting smaller as you go from kingdom to class. Orbitals come in different shapes. There are different categories of orbitals, and we'll talk about that in a second. But one very important thing to realize is that regardless of what type of orbital an orbital is, any individual orbital is able to contain at most 2 electrons. And that means, in terms of how many electrons are in an orbital, there are 3 possibilities exactly. It can be empty, 0 electrons, half full, 1 electron, or full, 2 electrons. Okay? Can't pack more than 2 electrons into a single orbital. Now, there are, speaking of categories of orbitals, symbols we give to these different categories. There are S orbitals, there are P orbitals, there are D orbitals, there are F orbitals. D and F you can learn about if you're interested in a chemistry course. That's deeper into it than we need to get here. So I'm going to just confine our discussion to the S-type orbitals and the P-type orbitals. Now, there are some of both of those types of orbitals pictured here in slide 7. This small circle, which when you imagine it in three dimensions as a sphere, is an S orbital. All S orbitals are spherical in shape. So that's one. This bigger one is also an S orbital. And then there are three P orbitals shown here. Each one is individually shaped like an infinity symbol, only in three dimension, or a dumbbell. Okay, so that's one. This is another. And that's the third. There are three P orbitals here. Every level, including level one, includes an S subshell. What defines a subshell is that that subshell contains all of the orbitals of the same type that are in that level. So level one contains an S subshell. That S subshell, by definition of being a subshell, contains all of the type S orbitals. But for a single level, there's only ever one S orbital in that level, so there's really three different names given to the same space for level one. Level one contains an S orbital, and subshell, I mean, which consists of one S orbital. And so the S orbital, the S subshell, and the first energy level really all refer to the same thing, this small sphere here. Okay? It's one set whose subset is really the set again, and the subset of that subset is the whole set again. Level 2 has its own S subshell containing the single S orbital that level has, which is this orbital right here. This is the second level's S orbital. When we symbolize orbitals, we put an integer in front to denote the level that it's a member of, so that first S subshell, the small sphere, would be the one S orbital. And that's the only thing you find in that entire level. It makes up the whole subshell, S subshell, and that's the only subshell that's in the first level, and therefore it makes up the entire level. The S orbital that is a member of level 2 is denoted as the 2S orbital. It's just one orbital, but 2s means it's a member of level 2. And that makes up the entire S subshell of level 2. Okay? But starting with level 2, unlike level 1, 2 and above, every level also contains a P subshell. Because only levels 2 and above contain P orbitals. Okay? But a P subshell contains all of the P-type orbitals. And any shell that contains any P orbitals, which is 2 and above, have exactly 3 P orbitals in that level. That's why you see 3 right here. Okay? This is in part of level 2. Level 2 contains this 2S orbital. And it contains 3 different P orbitals. And by the way, this is a two-dimensional representation, but the P orbitals, these dumbbell shapes, are mutually orthogonal, which is really just a way of saying that each of them is perpendicular to the other two. So one of them is facing this way, one of them this way, and then the third of this way. Each one is perpendicular to the other two. Just like the X, Y, and Z axes of a three-dimensional space or graph. So, in addition to the second level's S subshell, which contains the 2S orbital, there is a P subshell, sorry, containing three different 2P orbitals. And to distinguish the P orbitals, we give them X, Y, and Z
subscripts.
Okay, so 2px, 2py, and 2pz collectively make up the P subshell of level 2, but each of them individually is an orbital. Now, have I confused anyone with all this? Okay. So, how many levels are we looking at in this cartoon? Two levels. How many orbitals are here? Well, how many total to orbitals?
Five
total orbitals. How many are in level two? How many orbitals? How many subshells in level two?
Two,
exactly. Okay, and so armed with the knowledge that an individual orbital can contain at most two electrons, that means level one can contain how many total electrons?
Two.
And how many can level two contain? Eight, because level two is made up of four orbitals, each of which can contain two. That 8 for level 2 is the basis of what in chemistry is called the octet rule, if you've ever learned about that. Okay, but back to this notion of periods on the periodic table representing levels. This is why there are only two elements in the first period, hydrogen and helium, and that huge space between them is meaningless. They're the only members of that period, though. And that's because level 1 contains only one total orbital, the 1s orbital. Right? Well, what makes hydrogen hydrogen is that it has exactly one proton. What makes it a neutral atom of hydrogen is that it also, therefore, has one electron. And that is one electron that can be contained in the 1s. Helium is helium because it has two protons. A neutral atom of helium will have two electrons to counteract those protons in charge. And therefore, you're done as far as level one is concerned, right? Because level one can contain only those two electrons. Lithium is lithium because it has three protons and therefore three electrons. But that third electron can't go in the first level, because level one is already filled with its first two electrons. So that third electron that lithium has needs to go in the next level up, farther from the nucleus. And that's why it's in its own period. It's why it's in the next period. So any given element, any given atom of an element, has a certain level or shell that is the outermost level containing at least one electron. For hydrogen and helium, that's just level one, right? For lithium, it's level two, though. And this brings up potentially confusing terminology using the word valence. This is used three different ways. So make sure you understand the difference between the three ways this is used. One way is to describe what's called a valence shell. A valence shell is simply the outermost shell that contains at least one electron for an atom. And therefore, for lithium, the valence shell is shell 2. Right? For hydrogen and helium, the valence shell is shell 1. Because shell 2 is totally empty and therefore all the other ones are empty, we ignore them. So we just refer to a valence shell for any given atom. That's one use, pretty straightforward. Another way we use the word, though, is in the phrase number of valence electrons. Well, first of all, valence electrons are simply electrons that are found in an atom's valence shell. So for any atom at level 2 or above, so starting with lithium, there are both valence electrons and non-valence electrons. Lithium has three total electrons, but the first two fill up that inner shell, and so they are not valence electrons. It has one valence electron. Right? That's another use of the word. And the potentially confusing part comes in when we just use the word by itself. We can talk about an atom's valence. The valence is not the same thing as the number of valence electrons. The valence is how many additional electrons you would have to give to that atom to fill up its valence shell. Or, strictly speaking, a valence subshell. But anyway, the definition stands. All right? How many more you would have to give it? So, for instance, hydrogen. Well, no. Let's say oxygen instead. First, notice where oxygen is. It is element number 8. That means it has, along with its 8 protons that define it as oxygen, 8 electrons, 8 total electrons. Right? 2 of those quickly fill up the first shell. So those are non-valence electrons. It has 6 valence electrons then. The other 6 are in its valence shell, so they are valence electrons. And notice, by the way, that in that valence shell, which is period 2, it takes 6 steps from the left to get to oxygen. One for each of those atoms. One for each of those electrons. Okay, so that's, it has 6 valence electrons. But its valence is what? Its valence is 2, because that valence shell, which is shell 2, contains 4 orbitals total, and therefore the level can hold 8. To get to that fullness, it needs 2 more above 6. And that's what valence is. Now, practically speaking, using the periodic table, you can think of the valence as being how many steps away from the right edge it is. Notice oxygen is 2 steps from neon. So let's also be sure we understand what types of elements there are. A lot of periodic tables will have a stair step right here diagonally. This one doesn't. But anyway, anything that's below and to the left of that, which is most elements, are metals. Most elements are metals. The things that are above and to the right of that diagonal are the nonmetals, comparatively few nonmetals. But the nonmetals are used in a hell of a lot of substances. Okay? All of these, though, are metals, except, by the way, hydrogen. Hydrogen, even though it's way over here on the left edge, is considered a nonmetal, along with all these ones that are above that diagonal. Did you have a question? That's right. That's right. And the noble gases, by the way, are important. So I'm glad you said that, because I had already forgotten to say that while I was over here. All of these ones that are in the rightmost group, remember that a column is a group, and everything within the same group have similar properties, like all the members of this group on the right edge. Those are the noble gases, which are content, so to speak, if you let me anthropomorphize atoms. Of course, they really don't have contentment, but they have high stability just by themselves. And that's because they have an outer or valence shell, or valence subshell more specifically, that is full. And in a full outer shell gives an atom very high stability. So, for energetic reasons, that atom doesn't want to make any changes. It's content the way things are, and therefore the noble gases just exist as single atoms that don't, under ordinary circumstances, undergo chemical reactions with other types of atoms, even atoms of their same type, because they're already very stable. all the millions of chemical reactions that can occur in the universe are the result of all the rest of the things that are at least partially discontent, so to speak, trying to rearrange their particles so they can attain the stability of that right edge that the noble gases have, including oxygen that we used as an example. It's two steps away from neon. It will want to react with things in such a way that it will have the stability of neon. And that's why valence is so important. But that'll become clear more in a minute. First, let me go to slide 8, which is really just a refinement of this slide 7. Slide 8 shows you the same information, but spaces it out. So hopefully, if you don't already understand what I've said in words, it will become more clear here. The first shell, a space, is made up of just one subshell, which itself is made up of just one orbital. So for that level only, the level, the subshell, and the orbital all refer to the same space. Okay? The 1s orbital. That's why the entire level can hold only 2 electrons at most. The second level, though, contains 2 different subshells, because there are 2 different types of orbitals found in it, S orbital and P orbitals. Well, the S subshell contains just the one, the single 2s orbital, and the single P subshell contains all 3 of the different 2p orbitals. Right? No new information. Well, yes, there is a bit of new information. At the top of the screen, notice that an atom is depicted with its nucleus, with no definition to the nucleus. It's just that's where the protons and neutrons are. But then you see these yellow rings around the nucleus with the dots in them, dots representing electrons. Now, they're labeled, so you can tell what they are from there. But if they weren't labeled, you should be able to know that these yellow rings can't possibly represent orbitals. And why is that?
Is it because there's no p orbitals attached to them?
Well, I'm saying an entire ring can't possibly be an orbital.
Right.
And it doesn't actually matter about whether it's S or P or any other kind. It can't possibly be an orbital because there are more than 2 electrons in it. Right? I already told you that a single orbital of any type can never hold more than 2 electrons. So these are not orbitals, and they're not even subshells. They are the entire shell, the level. Notice there's 4 pairs of electrons in this second shell, which happens for neon, which has 10 total electrons, but 8 of them in the second shell, which totally fills all 4 of these orbitals. But each pair represents one full orbital. There are 3 p's that are full and an s that is full in the second level. Is that all clear? All right. Well, slide 9 is really just an abbreviated version of the periodic table showing these rings representing levels. But here the notion of valence can be easier to understand using this figure compared to just the normal periodic table. I told you that the metals are most of the elements that are on the left side, and excluding hydrogen. Well, since the right edge, remember, represents fullness of a valence shell, that means the metals, being on the left, have a valence shell that is more empty than it is full. There's some number of electrons in them, otherwise we wouldn't consider them to be levels, right? But the number of electrons that are in that outer shell for a metal is comparatively few, because to fill it, you would have to add more electrons than you already have there. It's more empty than it is full. for a metal. For a non-metal, it's exactly the opposite. Lithium is a metal. Notice it has just one valence electron. It would take seven more to fill that second shell up, right? And well, for a non-metal like fluorine, which is closer to the right edge, that's just another way of saying that its valence shell is more full than empty. Fluorine only needs one more to get to that nice stability that neon already has, fullness of an outer of a valence shell. Okay, so that's why we say fluorine has a valence of one. It's trying to get to that nice stable condition that of fullness of outer shell. Metals, on the other hand, aren't even close, right, compared to nonmetals. Okay, so that's going to determine how things react and how they form bonds in order to increase their stability valence-wise. Let's go to 10 now and start talking about chemical bonds. Not all bonds, by the way, we'll talk about various bonds, but not all bonds, which are attractive forces, are chemical bonds. A bond is a chemical bond only if the formation of that bond results in the creation of new substance. Now, here we have a representation of exactly the same chemical reaction that we started with at the beginning of the chapter, last time we were here, where we have a metal, sodium, and a non-metal, chlorine, both dangerous and deadly by themselves, reacting to form a new substance that's neither sodium nor chlorine. It's sodium chloride, a compound that is not only not dangerous but absolutely necessary, as we've said. Okay. This is just a different representation of it, but the point here is really not the reaction. The point is the type of bond that's forming. It is a chemical bond, though, because when that bond is formed, you no longer have the same stuff. You have new substance. That's what defines it as a chemical reaction. Not all bonds do this. Okay, so the first chemical bond, since there's no order to these bonds, but first the one we're starting with, since it's shown here in this slide, are ionic bonds. Ionic bonds involve the formation of ions, which is a word I used offhandedly earlier to refer to a charged particle. Ions are charged overall, and so we don't use the word atom anymore. Instead, we use the word ion. The reason that the whole thing can be charged, I'm not talking about individual subatomic particles. Those are always have charge. Well, for protons and electrons. I'm talking about the overall atom. The way it can become charged is to simply, since you can't change the charges on individual subatomic particles, they're either negative or positive. The way for the whole thing to have a charge, therefore, is for the number of protons to no longer equal the number of electrons. They are equal in an atom, which is neutral, and that's why it's neutral, right? The number of positives plus the same number of negatives add up to zero. Well, if you think about this, there's four ways that you could cause this difference in the number of positives and negatives, and therefore have an overall thing that's charged. You could either add protons or subtract protons, or you could add electrons or subtract electrons, right? Four different ways. Any of those individually would result in the condition of having not the same number of protons as electrons, and therefore it would have a charge, correct? Well, only two of those really happen in ion formation. The protons stay put. So protons aren't added or subtracted in chemical reactions. They just stay in the nucleus that they are a member of originally. Therefore, the only way under normal circumstances to make something an ion is to either add electrons or take electrons away. Some number, one or more. Okay? If you, by the way, if you do change the number of protons, you're changing the element. And that happens, for instance, in radioactive decay. One element will decay into a different element because it loses protons. But we're not talking about that when we're talking about ordinary chemical reactions. In chemical reactions, the nuclei are not really involved. And that should make sense because of how we said atoms are arranged. When two atoms, whether they're the same type or different types, react, they first have to come together, right? They have to meet each other. And when they encounter each other, it's not the nuclei that encounter each other. Those are deep. It's the outer edges, specifically the electron cloud, and more specifically, the valence shell, the outer shell. Those are the electrons that come into contact with each other and get rearranged in any given chemical reaction. Okay, now, if you have a metal reacting with a non-metal, that's going to result in the formation of ions, and that will lead to an ionic bond. That's exactly what we're seeing in this example. We have a metal, sodium, and a non-metal, chlorine, right? Left side and right side of the periodic table. Because of what I've said before, metals being mostly empty in their valence shell, and also because of what I said about ignoring shells that are totally empty, sodium, with its one valence electron in level 3, which is its current valence shell, finds it much easier to just get rid of that one electron than it would be to take on 7 additional electrons, right? And the reason that still leads to stability is because if it loses this one, then we no longer consider level 3. It's empty. And level 2, therefore, is its new valence shell, which is already full, just like the immediately previous atom. Sodium is number 11. If it loses that one valence electron that it has at the moment, its new valence shell will be shell 2, already full, just like neon, making it nice and stable. So that's what it wants to do. And metals in general form ions by losing electrons rather than gaining them. Okay? Because they are more empty than full in their valence shell. For chlorine, it's exactly the opposite situation, and for a nonmetal in general, too. It's almost all the way to the right edge already. So it's much easier to take on one additional electron than it is to get rid of 7. And so it seems that these two are made for each other, right? Because chlorine will gladly take the electron off of sodium's hands, and sodium is trying to get rid of that one of electron. And it will make both of them much more stable than they are as atoms. But this transfer of an electron from one to the other, specifically from the metal to the nonmetal, simultaneously creates two ions, right? They both become ions in this process. Because each of them no longer has the same number of electrons as protons. They have the same number of protons, but now they have a new number of electrons, and therefore they don't add up to 0. Okay? Ions, by the way, is a big group. Anything that's charged, any atom, more or less, that's charged, or group of atoms, but we're talking about single atoms, we can break the group of ions down into anions and cations, though, which are non-overlapping categories, mutually exclusive. So any given ion is either an anion or a cation. You'll see these prefixes, an and cat, in other words as well, like anode and cathode. And in biology, you can see them in different kinds of fishes, depending on whether they swim upstream or downstream to spawn, can be classified as anadromous or catadromous, using the same opposites. Cat means down, by the way, which is why a catheter, which lets down fluid, is called that. Anyway, any given ion is either an anion or a cation, never both at the same time. Well, metals lose electrons. What is the charge that that ion is going to have, therefore? What charge do you get by losing electrons? What charge? You become positive, correct, when you lose negatives, right? Because now you have the same number of positives, but one fewer negative to counteract them. And yes, you're right. That qualifies you by being positive as a cation. Anions are formed when an atom takes on one or more electrons. Right? Taking on electrons makes you negative because now you have more negatives than positive. Okay, well, since metals are more empty than full in their valence shell and therefore lose electrons, metals in general become cations when they ionize. And nonmetals, since they're more full than empty in their valence shell, take on additional electrons and therefore become negative. They become anions in general. And so this happens for a metal and a nonmetal. It's a different situation if you have two metals or two nonmetals. We're talking about a reaction between a metal and a nonmetal here. Well, when, you know, it's just for stability reasons that there is this transfer of electrons from the metal to the nonmetal. That makes them both happy in terms of being like the noble gases on the right edge. So that's why it happens. But once it happens, you now all of a sudden have two different ions of opposite charge. The metal is positively charged, the metal ion, and the nonmetal ion is negatively charged, right? You have a cation and an anion. And opposite charges have an attraction, an electrostatic attraction. That is why, once these ions are formed, the two different ions are going to stick together, because of the force of electrostatic attraction between unlike charges. And that's what holds them together as a compound, not as sodium or chlorine, but as new stuff, a compound called sodium chloride. That bond is called an ionic bond. And it is comparatively weak. It's the weakest of the chemical bonds. It's not the weakest of the bonds. Even weaker bonds result in not new stuff. There might be an attraction, but you're not making new stuff. Ionic bonds are the weakest bonds that actually give you new substance. And by the way, I use the word compound. A compound is a substance made up of two or more different elements. That's not all chemical bonds make compounds. But ionic bonds make compounds because you have two different elements in order to make those two different ions, right? Okay. Next up is slide 11. And here we have sodium chloride again. But in the previous slide, we had the situation that effectively never happens of having exactly one sodium atom and one chlorine atom becoming ionized into one sodium ion and one chloride ion. Yes, the two will stick together. But in real situations, you have trillions and trillions of sodium and chlorines, not just one of each. And the important point here is that when the ionization occurs by the metal transferring an electron to the nonmetal, that makes the positively charged sodium ion positive in all directions, to all onlookers. It looks positive from all directions. And similarly, the chloride ion is negative from all directions. Therefore, it's not an ionic bond doesn't form between just two oppositely charged ions. In the real situation of having plenty of sodium ions and plenty of chloride ions, they all clump together because each yellow sodium ion is attracted to all of the chloride ions around it, and each green chloride ion is attracted to all of the yellow sodium ions around it. So it's not just a group of two. It's instead a group, a clump, a crystal that can be indeterminately big. Just as depends on how many you have. When salt is mined for sale as sodium chloride table salt, they dig it out of chunks that are bigger than buildings. That's all one piece, molecularly speaking. That's not a molecule. An ionic compound, by the way, is another name for a salt. There's all kinds of different salts. When we say the word salt in everyday language, we usually mean table salt, because that's what we eat. But there's plenty of other salts. It just means an ionic compound. And ionic compounds, or salts, are not made up of molecules. A molecule is a predefined size. This has no predefined size, right? I just told you it can be as big or as small as you like, depending on how many ions are present, because they're all connected to each other. Now, there is a lower limit. There's no upper limit, but there is a lower limit. You can't have sodium chloride unless you have at least one of each of the ions, right? That's the bare minimum, like in the previous slide. So we don't call that a molecule, though, because it's not a predefined piece. Instead, we call the smallest possible piece of a salt a formula unit. And for sodium chloride, that would mean one sodium ion and one chloride ion. All right, that's ionic bonds. Makes new stuff. Those bonds are comparatively weak, though, and therefore easier to break. Next, let's go to slide 12 and talk about the next major category of chemical bonds, which are covalent bonds. Now, notice the word covalent has co in it, which means share, and valent, referring to valence electrons. So unlike an ionic bond, in which there is a transfer of an electron or more from one, namely the metal, to the other atom, namely the nonmetal, that's not what's happening here. The transfer in an ionic bond is more or less permanent. It becomes the property of the nonmetal, and it stays there. That's not what happens in a covalent bond. Covalent bonds don't occur between metals and nonmetals. If you have a metal and a nonmetal reacting, you're making a salt, an ionic bond, an ionic compound. Here, in this example, we have two hydrogens reacting. Now, hydrogen, remember, even though it's on the left edge, is a nonmetal. And in general, covalent bonds are formed only between two nonmetals. It can be two nonmetals of the same kind, like we see here, or two nonmetals that are different. But it's a nonmetal with another nonmetal for a covalent bond. So, like I said, there's relatively few nonmetals, just that upper right-hand corner, but there's really no limit to the number of ways you can combine them with covalent bonds. Okay, here's what's happening, though. We have two hydrogen atoms. What is the number of valence electrons for each atom? Hydrogen. One. And what is the valence? Also one, just by coincidence. Right? You'd have the same coincidence, by the way, for carbon. Carbon has four valence electrons, six overall, but four valence electrons. And it also happens to have a valence of four because 4 plus 4 equals 8. So, That's just by coincidence. For hydrogen, it's one and one because level one only holds two, and it's halfway there. So its valence is one. And practically speaking, in addition to what I've already said the valence is, you can think of that as telling you how many covalent bonds that atom needs to make to be satisfied. That'll become more clear a bit later. But we have two identical hydrogen atoms. Each one has a valence of one. Now, each one wants to get like helium on the right edge. And so each one would like to take on an additional electron, in other words, right? Well, you can't have that happen for both of them. They can't both get happy like a metal and a nonmetal can, because that would require having new electrons pop into existence, right? And that's not what happens in chemical reactions. The same amount of subatomic particles are there. They're not created or destroyed, they're just moved around. Moving them around was enough for a metal and a nonmetal. You didn't have to invent or destroy any electrons. Here you would have to have new electrons to satisfy them both. So they can't do that. And therefore, more or less, anthropomorphizing them again, giving them human qualities, that is, they strike a deal with each other. Each one says to the other, I will share my one electron with you if you promise to share your one electron with me. And in that process, in that deal, each of us will get credit for both of those electrons. So there's only two total electrons still, but if they're shared by both of the nuclei, then the two electrons will spend time around each of the two. And it will be like each atom has two electrons, just like helium, making them very stable. Yes, it's true that they don't spend 100% of the time around each of the two. But since they're going around both of them, and this is not the path they take, but they spend some time around each of them, that satisfies the valence, as we say. Okay? Gives them both a full outer shell, which in this case is shell one. And that is what holds them together, the sharing of the electrons. And it holds them together much more strongly than the force of electrostatic attraction between different ions does in an ionic bond. So it's also a chemical bond. You're forming new stuff, but with a much stronger bond between them and therefore much harder to break. Well, if this occurs, if a covalent bond occurs, is formed, then we also form what we call a molecule. That's the proper use of the word molecule. There aren't molecules of salt. There are molecules of covalent structures. Meaning molecule, the word molecules is really only some combination of nonmetals. Here you have two nonmetals of the same type, hydrogen and hydrogen. And by the way, that means this: what results here is not a compound, right? This is still an element. But now it's a diatomic element. It's made up of two atoms and one molecule. An atom by itself of hydrogen is also an element. It's hydrogen, but it's a monatomic element. And it's not as satisfied as the two are when they're sharing an electron. That's why you don't have normally you don't have very many hydrogen atoms. Instead, when there's plenty of hydrogen atoms, they react in pairs to form molecules of hydrogen gas, H2. But appreciate the difference between a molecule and what happens in a salt. Because when this deal is stricken and this molecule is formed, the trillions of other hydrogen atoms that are still around aren't going to be involved in this. These two that are in this molecule are done. They don't want to involve themselves with any other hydrogen atoms. So yes, you'll have trillions of other hydrogen molecules formed, but they'll remain as individual molecules. They might bounce off of each other, but they're not sticking together like a whole mass of ions in a salt are. Is that all clear? Okay, what's formed here is a single covalent bond. Not all covalent bonds are single covalent bonds, but importantly, and students often forget this, a single covalent bond is never involving a single electron. It's covalent. They share a pair of electrons. Each of them contributes one, and therefore what is shared is not a single electron, but a pair of electrons. And this single covalent bond consists of two electrons. In this special case of hydrogen, since it's so simple, since each of them has only one electron to begin with, which of course is its valence electron, then all of the electrons of these two atoms are tied up in the single covalent bond. But when nonmetals have a bigger number of electrons, like oxygen, for instance, only some of its electrons will be shared. Others will be the permanent property of that oxygen atom and will not be shared, including all of the non-valence electrons. The non-valence electrons are deeper in there. They're not going to be shared. Only maybe some of the valence electrons will be shared, and not necessarily all of them. But the use of the word single covalent bond implies that there can be such thing as a double covalent bond and even a triple. That's what we see in slide 13. So this one on the left, this reaction is what we just saw. Two hydrogen atoms, each wanting an additional electron, shares that one with the other so that they both get credit for both. What we have represented here aren't just symbols for hydrogen, but these are examples of Lewis dot diagrams or electron dot diagrams. And let me just explain quickly how these are done. For a Lewis dot diagram, you start out representing the nucleus with the symbol for the element, right? So you would start with an H. And then you use dots for the electrons. But in any Lewis dot diagram, you put down dots only for valence electrons. You don't bother putting any dots for the non-valence electrons because they're not going to be involved in reactions. Well, in the case of hydrogen, though, it has only one electron. That is valence. That is a valence electron. So you can put it anywhere around this that you want, but that represents an electron in one orbital. Well, it only has one orbital in that first level, right? The 1s orbital. And so that's a half-filled orbital, which is why hydrogen is not as happy as it could be. It has a valence of 1 because it wants an additional electron to be like helium. Same thing for the other hydrogen. Well, the deal that they've struck so that they can share these two is represented by this blue shaded region right here. Notice that that single bond consists of two electrons, a pair, not just one, because one from each of the two atoms is involved. And that holds them together nice and tightly as a hydrogen molecule. Well, look at oxygen, though. Oxygen is element number 8. That means it has 8 electrons as well as protons, right? So there are 8 total. You start with an oxygen symbol, though, and you don't write down all of those 8. You don't put 8 dots down because 2 of those are non-valence electrons, the 2 that fill up shell 1. Don't bother with those. So shell 2 is the valence shell, and valence shell 2 has how many orbitals?
8.
No. How many orbitals?
4
orbitals. Which is why you can think of the O having 4 corners here, or top, bottom, right, and left, representing 4 different orbitals. But the proper way to do this is one, conceptually, is one electron at a time. You're dealing only with valence electrons. And you have 6 that you need to allot into these 4 orbitals, right? But you start one at a time, only half filling an orbital before moving on. So that's one orbital, this is another orbital, that's the fourth orbital. You've run out of orbitals now, right? In this case. But you still have two more electrons to fill up. So then you start filling orbitals one at a time. This shows you that oxygen has two of its four valence orbitals filled. And these pairs of electrons are going to stay the property of oxygen. It has two unsatisfied orbitals, though, not completely filled. And those are the ones that are going to be involved in sharing so that it can also get credit for an additional two to fill those two orbitals. Well, if you have the same thing occurring with another oxygen atom, it's in exactly the same situation, then they're not going to share just one each with the other. They're going to share two each with the other. And these are going to become a double bond, which is represented here as four dots. A double covalent bond is two pairs of electrons, which sometimes are drawn just as lines. A covalent bond is drawn as two dots or as one line. And a double covalent bond is drawn as two lines. Now, as you might have guessed, a double covalent bond is even stronger than a single covalent bond. It not only holds them together, but it's harder to break apart than a single covalent bond. And if you go through this same exercise with nitrogen, nitrogen has three unsatisfied orbitals. It has a valence of three. It's three steps from the edge, notice. And therefore, it's going to form a nitrogen molecule, N2, by forming a triple bond. Oxygen can't do this. The valence of oxygen is two. That tells you any oxygen that is a member of a molecule has to be making a total of two bonds for that to be satisfied. Nitrogen has to be making three because of its valence. And any hydrogen has to be making one because of its valence. Well, this fact about nitrogen is what is... I'll just tell you something about that next time. It's important, though. But I've said enough for today.